Many people in our food community have been seriously impacted by Superstorm Sandy, and our hearts go out to them. At HRN, we've been covering these stories since the storm hit. To learn more, visit our website at www.heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some.
After an unfortunate last week of not being able to get into the studio, we are finally back at the Speakeasy at Heritage Radio Network. And in the studio today, we have a buddy of mine, Jan Warren, head bartender at Dutch Kills in Long Island City, in New York City, and also co-host of a really cool new show called Animals Eating Animals with his co-host, Jeff Kreger, Chef Jeff Kreger of The Beagle. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We call him Chef Jeff.
Chef Jeff. I know. I wish I would have come up with that.
It just works phonetically.
It just came to you. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. So, first of all, we recently, about a month ago or so, had Terrence Stanley on the show.
Sure,
so
I listened. I listened to the show while I was setting up the bar.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you always work on Wednesdays, yep. So that works out.
Yep.
So you recently became the head bartender, fairly recently became the head bartender over at Dutch Kills after working in several restaurants, both front and back of the house and bars. And I want to ask you this because I think you're probably the first person, at least that comes to mind, that came from like a very kind of hefty workload of the back of the house work to the front of the house and the bar. Do you feel like that gives you an advantage of like making the drinks and as far as like prep and everything goes?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when you're cooking, your workload is very similar to, you know, making drinks at the bar, but you can burn things, you can cut yourself. I mean, it's just a lot more dangerous and a lot more stressful. You know, it's more important. You're working with a team, and your timing has to be on, so you're all putting up plates for the same table at the same time. For me, it's a much more stressful environment. You know, what we do is still difficult, but it's not hot. You're not bathed in sweat. You're not coating parts of your body with cornstarch to avoid chafing. You know, you get to dress nice and not sweat. And you know, in the best of all worlds, I've worked no air conditioning shifts with, you know, towels dipped in ice water around my neck. But I think that a line cook has an automatic advantage at the bar just because, you know, as a line cook, your hours are longer than almost any bar shift you're going to encounter. Sure. And the stress level is just higher because you have, you know, you're back of house. There's people throwing things at you. There's a chef cursing at you. You feel like crying all the time. You know, I think it definitely is an advantage. Absolutely.
That's one thing that always got me, you know, whenever my bar, we don't have bar back. So anytime we need ice or you need to run and grab a bottle, or, you know, whatever it may be, you're running back to find your bar spoon that ended up in the dishwasher and never came back. But the thing that I was always jealous of was that they were actually able to curse at each other. And, you know, when you're a bartender, you're like, you have to be like very like on point and presentable. And then you just, a lot of times you want to go to the back and just scream for a second and then come back out.
Well, yeah, I think having that option is great. Unfortunately, when you're a line cook, you don't get to scream at anybody.
Right, that's true.
You just take abuse all day. I mean, a good friend of mine called his head chef one day. He referred to him as the abusive father he never wanted. I mean, and that kind of relationship really exists in a lot of kitchens. You know, I'd say because chefs work so hard to get where they are, A. Mm-hmm. B, the responsibility for everything that comes out of that kitchen is ultimately yours. And that's just an incredible weight to carry all the time. And, you know, I just watched the A Matter of Taste, the Paul LeBrant thing the other day. and he grabs a cook, takes him into a corner and says, I am only as strong as my weakest link in this kitchen. And right now you're the weakest link. And it's like that kind of thing is what happens in kitchens all the time. It's never going to happen at a bar because you can't talk to bartenders the way you can talk to line cooks, because kitchens have a culture that is military, that is psychologically destructive to build up. You know what I'm saying?
Sure,
it's,
sure.
It's like going to boot camp.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? So, you know, there are things I want to say to bartenders sometimes that I just can't say to them because they'll cry and quit.
Sure.
Whereas as a line cook, you'll just cry and work harder.
I think, totally. I think also, like, as a bartender, especially, like, working in, like, classic kind of cocktail bars, you take on a lot more responsibilities, much more, like, managerial roles, you know, because a lot of times you have to, you know, be every person in the place, but as, like a one-man army, basically. And, I mean, albeit you do have your coworkers with you, but, I mean, there are a lot of things that you have to be very... very proactive.
Well, it's more like a one man kitchen. Each bar station is a one man kitchen because you're working that station and you're all putting out the same drinks. It's not like a kitchen that's split between garde manger and desserts and pastry and saute and grill and fryer. And, you know, you don't have that kind of delineation between things. So yeah, it is in that sense, a one man kitchen, each bar station. And that's good, I think, because it just allows you to just work independently. And that is nice. I like that a lot.
Well, that being said, at certain cocktail bars too, there are, and I like this. Joaquin's new bar, Joaquin and Toby, they have the Pouring Ribbons bar. And one cool thing about that, and for some reason I was thinking that you guys did this too, but basically everyone does they work every role.
We absolutely do alternate. Yeah, I mean, I think we have some floor people who only work the floor. But that's because they're timid and don't want to work the bar yet.
Sure.
You know, we have a girl that works there who has been working there for 2 years, knows all the drinks, you know, and is just a little timid. And you know, if you don't have the confidence to be behind the bar, you shouldn't be behind the bar. But yeah, I work the floor sometimes. Scott Teague, who works with me, works the floor sometimes. Sometimes he works the bar. We pretty much swing it around, yeah.
It's a great concept, you know, because then that way you can be on top of it all the time. Even if you are working one position, then you can see where one,
right.
Another one needs
help. Yeah. And it also helps you know, how long a round takes, you know, so you're not like, you're not cranky with the service bartender who's not putting out your round fast enough because you know that he's got four tickets and you have an idea how long that takes. You know, also that's one of the ideas I always had for, you know, my dream restaurant when I was cooking. Would be to have everybody do everything. Because in a restaurant, there's always this huge divide between front of house and back of house.
Absolutely.
And even, I would say, past divide and going into lack of respect, unfortunately, mm-hmm. where waiters think that cooks are all animals and cooks think that waiters are all stupid. And, you know, it really is pretty sad because everybody in a restaurant works really hard. I mean, everybody does. And I always thought that it would be nice for a waiter to get a look at what a cook does and for a cook to get a look at what a waiter does, because it's easy to be sweating in the kitchen and thinking, man, these guys look all good out front and their lives are easy and they're making more money than me and whatever. But the reality is that when you're dealing with six tables, eight tables, it's not comfortable.
Sure.
I mean, people want you more than you can be there sometimes. And ultimately, if you have a responsibility to the work, it feels bad to not do the job you think you can do.
Sure. I also think that with that being said, like those certain roles, like the power gets shifted from like when you're waiting a table, you're basically at the whim of the customer.
Right.
And you're doing everything to keep them happy. But then the flip side of that is like when you're a bartender, you're in charge.
Sure.
And the customer is like at your, you know. So it's good to like see both sides of that side of power. So like when you are bartending, you can be like, all right, you know, I'm about the customer.
It's funny. My kind of floor persona doesn't change from the bar. I basically tell tables what they're going to have.
Sure.
I mean, I really do. I still, if I'm working the floor at Dutch Kills, I am in control of those tables. I really am. I tell them I really guide them through their drinking experience. And I don't think we give up a lot of control at Dutch Kills. I think in a restaurant, it's different. And I think that people come into even cocktail bars with the idea that whoever's waiting the table is too dumb to bartend.
Sure.
Because, I mean, people's expectations shift of people's expectations of you shift based on what position you're in. And right. the bartender is a guy that knows all the drinks and he can shake cans and he can stir and he can make ice melt in a glass. I mean, he's a magician, right? But the waitress or the waiter can only carry a tray.
Right.
You know, so people tend to have that misconception that these people aren't good enough to be behind the bar. Whereas, you know, a lot of them are, and just, you know, either are both things or just are don't want to be behind the bar. Some people are way more comfortable on the floor. So at our bar, if someone comes in with the notion that the person bringing them their drinks is just someone who can bring drinks, they're quickly disabused of it.
Sure.
I mean, quickly.
Yeah.
I hit people.
Like all the time. Smack them with a tray over the head. Well, I think that's also cool for your regulars that come in too, to see that you're not above like going out on the floor, like as the bartender and the person running the show, like getting out on the floor and actually getting your hands dirty in a different way and like being a team, you know, that shows a lot of teamwork.
And yeah. Really I mean, cool. And that's a suit. I mean, look, you work in a business that is it only works when the people that work behind the scenes are happy together. Really. I mean, it can work. I shouldn't say only works. It can work with conflict, but it works just way better, way easier. Everybody feels better. Everybody in the end makes more money, because if your staff feels good, your customers feel good.
Sure.
Your customers want to be there. Your customers want to tip better. I mean, you know, you walk into restaurants all over town, bars all over town, and you can instantly feel it. I mean, this is a thing that, you know, it's something I've always noticed about restaurants and better and good restaurants. And, you know the management's good because you walk in and it's not because you got treated really well by the staff, or there's just a sense that you have that the staff is happy and treated well. And when that happens, I mean, good things start from there. I mean, really. And that's part of why Dutch Kills works so well, I think. And you know, the other bars in the family, Milk and Honey, Little Branch, all the bars, Silver Lining, you know, is because our bosses are actually pretty good people.
I mean,
and that's really important. And they inspire loyalty, they inspire dedication, and they inspire hard work, because they've done all that, right?
Sure.
They've been loyal, they've been dedicated, they've been hardworking, and still are. I don't mean to say that any of those guys are mailing it in now, because they're not. I see Richie, you know, at the bar, you know, 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week. You know,
when he's not on a motorcycle trip,
right? When he's not when he's not traveling around the world making me jealous.
Yeah. with that experience, I want to start hitting on something we're going to talk about in the second half of the show. We're going to take a little break here in a second, but with giving those kinds of experiences to your customers, and also obviously on your days off, you want to have the similar kind of experience. You recently started working on some different projects, one of them being this TV show, Animals Eating Animals.
Sure.
But before we get into that, I know there was something like that hit me like whenever I started working in like better bars, and it was realizing that, okay, we're giving people, like our customers, these great products, this great environment. They're here to have fun. They're here to have fun. And, you know, then as a bartender and as someone who works in the industry, that started rubbing off on me. So then on my days off, I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to cruise around town. We live in a great city. There's plenty of stuff that's offered. So let's go see what everyone else is doing, what they're cooking, what they're mixing,
you sure. know,
what they're making in general, you know.
I mean, sure.
So many great companies putting out like great products.
There is no dearth of wonderment and beauty in the restaurant and bar industry in this town. I mean, it's probably... You know, I'm New York centric. I grew up here, so I'm going to say stuff that you're not going to like if you're not from here, but this is the best town on the planet. That's why everybody comes here. That's why you look around and there's Africans, Japanese, Russians. I mean, this is the city. It's called the city. There are thousands of cities, but this one is the city,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what it is. And you know, the options available to us are manifold and beautiful, and I'm so happy to be able to visit all these ethnic places that are tiny dirt holes that put out one beautiful product, you know, and yeah, we explore, me and my co-host on the show, Jeff Kreger, explore that and, you know, wanted to share it with the world, really. And I think we'll talk more about that.
Yeah, right after this break. So we will be back in just a moment. We're talking with Jan Warren, and give us a minute.
We'll be right back.
You are listening to Kill Me in the Summertime by the Dead Stars on heritageradionetwork.org. Following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
And we are back. We've been talking with Jan Warren of head bartender at Dutch Kills and also co-host of a new show called Animals Eating Animals.
Before we talk about animals eating animals, I know that radio is not a visual medium, but is there any reason we're not wearing pants? You know,
I just feel more comfortable in this conversation.
All right.
It's just, you know what, you're in my house now.
I got it. I want
to abide by my rules.
Okay.
Before the show, we were talking cocktails and we were talking about customer experiences and everything, and about being in a great city with a lot to offer.
Sure.
And basically getting into the conversation about having fun with it and exploring, and you know, your show.
To make this easy and short, my show, and I say my, and I mean me and Jeff. Jeff, if you're listening, I love you deeply. Not physically, but deeply. It just comes from basically what me and my buddy did on our days off. You know,
yeah.
This is a great town for a bicycle. It is.
Sure.
If you're good at riding one, if you suck at biking, get off your bike.
I think in the second episode, Jeff took a spill.
He takes a spill, and he's good at it. He is.
You got to know how to fall.
You got to know how to fall, for one. And also, you just have to be kind of, man, hyper aware.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to have lasers coming out of the back of your head. 100%. I can't stress this enough. You make me nervous, all of you. You do. I've been doing this since I was 16. That's 21 years of riding a bike in New York City in traffic. Please be careful.
Seriously.
Really, people get hurt. Anyway, and so did my co-host in episode two. So. basically on our day off, me and Jeff would get on our bikes on a nice day, ride around and gorge, stuff ourselves. I mean, we both love food. We're both not afraid of things that you might think are strange. This is what we did, and it just kind of evolved into a show very naturally. And you know, you can't not go to Flushing. You can't not go to Sunset Park, which for my money is kind of my favorite food neighborhood in the city, because you're in Mexico on Fifth Avenue and in China on Eighth Avenue. And that's about as far as it gets.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Culinarily, it's pretty wildly different. And, you know, I think you owe it to yourself if you live here to explore this city, whether, you know, and explore it to find what you love. You know, me and Jeff happen to love food, and we want to share that with you. Watch our show. Animals Eating Animals, animalnewyork.com.
Well, that's the whole spirit of even moving to this city. It's like no one lives in this city if you have fears of, you know, like these weird, timid little, you know.
Oh, they do. It's called the Upper East Side.
Well, that's true.
I mean, they do. They just go to bars in Murray Hill, and that's as far as they get. They're 86th to 35th, and that's it from 3rd, you know, 1st Avenue to 3rd Avenue.
But that's not living in New York City, though.
I know that. But there are a lot of people who come from other places and just really, you know, they come to work a corporate job in New York because it's where they're going to make it. And they basically seek out the experience that they had in their small college town,
Sure.
You know, and their fraternity, and, you know, and they're totally hot sorority girls at Tramp Stamps. I mean, they look for that, and they're all at Brother Jimmy's right now, you know, and that's great. And I'm glad we have a place for those people. I am. We need that. It's New York. There's everybody's here, and it really doesn't pay to hate anybody, to be angry at anybody. You know, you can think that people are mildly foolish for not exploring what this city has to offer. But, you know, like I said, we have great art. We have great food. Food is art, I guess, in a lot of ways. You know, and I think you owe it to yourself, if you're here, to abuse the city, to use it for what it is, which is a melting pot, if you will. It's a fondue pot of stuff. You know, whatever you want, you can find it here, and you can find the best of it here. And I really firmly believe that. In fact, one of my ideas for a show would be New York versus the World.
Nice.
Where you find something.
I think that's the name of a Wu-Tang album.
Is it?
I don't know.
I hope
shaking his head no.
I hope so. Well, you know, where you kind of take the best thing you can find in New York in a certain area and then pit it against, you know, your best cheesesteak in New York versus your best cheesesteak in Philly. Or,
sure.
You know, that I think that would be a really neat thing to do. And I would be willing to bet that New York would win a lot of those battles.
You're going
to
piss off a lot of Philadelphians.
Well, sorry, cheesesteak guys. That was just an example. I haven't had a great cheesesteak in New York in recent memory. So it was just an example. It's because Philly is so famous for the cheesesteak.
Sure, sure.
That came to mind. And you know, I love you guys.
Well, give us some examples of, for those who haven't seen the show yet, some of the things that you've eaten. Like, what are some of the weirdest things that you've had to eat?
I mean, I would say that the weirdest thing we ate, or the thing that might be most alien to the American palate, is probably congealed duck's blood. I think that we don't eat a lot of blood here. We'd let it drip out of the meat, and in most cases across the country, cook it right out of the meat, which is pretty sad. But, you know, if you like, I mean, we've all cut our finger, right, and sucked on it, right? Everybody's done that.
Sure.
And 9 out of 10 of you probably like that slight coppery tang. So guess what? You're going to like congealed duck's blood. It might sound like something you'd never put in your mouth. It might sound like something that, you know, a horror movie guy is eating, but it's actually pretty good. You know, lamb testicles, you know, nobody wants to have balls in their mouth.
Well,
all right. There might be a certain segment of the population that really enjoys that. But, you know, for an American eating, for someone that's grown up in the traditional American food culture, I mean, nothing is stranger than balls, right? And that's what they are, you know? Yeah. That's what they are. But if they're handled well, I mean, if they're prepared well, if they're cooked well, if they're seasoned right, if they're seared nicely and cooked, I mean, you can get something that's really delicious. And I think that that's largely ignored, although that is obviously swinging the other way, especially in larger cities around the country. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, we're wasting less meat, which is nice.
Well, that's great. Like, you know, we were talking about from before the show, you know, I'm from a small town in Oklahoma. We grew up around a lot of Indian reservations, and, you know, Native Americans would use every piece of, like, the buffalo or cow, you know. And so in that respect, you know, being, like, basically cooking responsibly with the things that we're killing, you know, that's huge. And a lot of people aren't used to it, though.
Yeah, I mean, not only is it important to cook responsibly with what you're killing, because you're killing an animal when you eat a steak. You've now killed an animal. You haven't done it with your own hands, but that animal's dead, buddy.
Yeah.
So if you're eating a steak, you should probably eat a cow foot soup. You should probably have some sweetbreads. I mean, you should not be afraid to eat the rest of that animal. You should, you know, these animals have evolved on this planet the same way we have, right? They deserve our respect. They might not be the primary species, but they deserve our respect. And absolutely, part of respecting them is eating them, I think, from nose to tail. It is.
Sure. So on the show also, Jeff is, Jeff's the food guy, even though you both are obviously food guys.
Sure.
On the show, you typically mix a drink.
Yep.
How do you go about like deciding what you're going to pair?
I mean, that happens different ways. I mean, sometimes it's really pairing it to the food, but, you know, we did an episode where we ate all this lamb offal, and, you know, I didn't really have a good idea of what cocktail was going to go with that, but it was an Egyptian restaurant. So I made a little branch drink called an African flower, because Egypt is kind of the flower of Africa, you know, but it changes from maybe some kind of just mental association to, you know, like in the episode where we had a pig's face, I really thought that a Negroni style drink, something bitter, would really cut across the richness of pork jowl, you know, and the saltiness of brine pig. Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it goes two ways, you know, it's not always the same process. And I think that that's pretty good. I like that.
Yeah. You also ate the eyeball on that episode.
Jeff ate the eye.
Oh, he did?
Okay. Yeah. I drank liquefied pork fat out of the ear, which was really, I mean, you know, you're cheating yourself if you're not doing stuff like this. You are. If you're eating meat and you're not willing to drink some hot pork fat that's got star anise and other flavor in it, then
that's so awesome.
You're cheating yourself. Yeah. You really are. If you're not eating nacho cheese Doritos crumbled up on top of ice cream, you're cheating yourself. Because these are all experiences, and some of them might not be great for you, but you owe yourself the experience. Because bad experiences are important to form who you are. They are. I've had tons of them. Trust me. I wouldn't be this person, which I tend to think is a pretty good person. I don't know. Maybe not. Whatever. But, you know, there's been a lot of bad shit that's happened along the way.
He can curse. It's okay.
Yes.
Fuck yeah.
All right. So, you know, I think all these experiences are important. And even if they're negative at the time, they're going to be positive in the future. So eat whatever, do whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in it wasn't the culinary or even drinks epicenter of the world by a long damn shot. So, you know, growing up, my parents didn't really, they never really like branched out as far as like things that we would eat.
Canned green beans and.
We always had like a garden where we'd, oh, okay. You know, at least we had that, you know.
Well, that's pretty forward, right? I mean,
sure.
I'd say the average person in Oklahoma is not growing their own food, eating their own. That's, I mean, maybe that's right. A narrow view because I'm a New York jerk, but.
Well, but also it was like, you know, we're landlocked, you know, so even when I moved to Oklahoma City, it's like, you know, I'd go to an oyster bar, but I'd never eat the oysters because it was like.
Because they were shipped in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like with every step. Or in every stage of my life, it's like I had always seek out more and more, you know.
Sure.
And I think that that's what, you know, like my friend Andrew Knowlton, he writes for Bon Appetit. He, his daughter, Julep, eating oysters when she was like a year old.
Yeah, I mean, I was.
And I was like, that is badass. It took me like almost 30 years.
When I was really young, my family lived in Austin, Texas. And one of my earliest memories, this is real. One of my earliest memories is of parties outside with a wheelbarrow. Full of ice and oysters,
nice.
Where people would just shuck their own oysters and slurp them down. And I was eating oysters. That's one of my first memories, is eating an oyster out of an ice-packed wheelbarrow. You know, and that stuff is important. If you want to pass that kind of tradition on to your kids, it's important to get them eating weird stuff. I got a six-year-old. Well, he's eight now, but sorry, Lorenzo and Sherry. I have a nephew who was eating sushi when he was six. You know, I mean, that's... And my dad was taking me to sushi places when I was... 5 years old, 7 years old. I was eating Indian food in the early 80s in New York when it was only 6th Street. That's it.
Yeah.
There was nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, like, to me, those are the experiences. Even, like, and even with drinking responsibly, you know, like, reading Toby Cicchini's book, Cosmopolitan, he talks about, you know, being at the dinner table. And, you know, it's pretty traditional, though, of, like, Italian families, like, serving, you know, watered down wine to the kids,
sure,
you know,
sure.
And just like understanding like the responsibility on that side of it as well. I think that's super huge and something that I feel like we're actually getting back to.
Sure.
You know, it feels pretty good, you know, these days. And especially since we have great broadcasting situations like your show and hopefully this one.
Yeah, this is great.
We can educate people more on that.
I've had a great time today. I really have.
Yeah, likewise.
I mean, we're getting pretty close to the end, right?
We are at the end, actually.
Well, I want to say one thing before we go, and that's that I just want to say thank you to the bartenders out there who are really actively making a difference in this hurricane situation in New York. Jason Luttrell, you know, everybody that showed up at Pegu Club on Sunday. Audrey Saunders for loaning the community her bar for a night. I know that a lot of other people are doing a lot of really good work, and it really is, you know, I think you figure out what kind of person you are by how you respond to these kind of situations. And I think that it's just made me really happy to be associated, even loosely, with so many people that are out there
absolutely
trying to do the right thing for people that desperately need it right now. So I would say, I want to just say one thing and then you know, just if you have the opportunity, just go out and pick up a shovel or just get to a community near you if you're on the East Coast that's been damaged by this storm and try to help out because people really need it.
Absolutely. Awesome. Jan, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's an honor. Thank you.
Absolutely. And hopefully we'll get you back on the show sometime. I know you and I have no end to our conversation.
Yeah, ever. I think we could do okay at this.
We do all right. All right. That's it for the Speakeasy this week. I'm Damon Bolte. Cheers, guys, and be safe.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.